At the end of each station reading, press pause. Proceed to next station. Press play when you are ready to begin next reading.
Welcome to the Stations of the Cross here at St. Andrew. I hope that this offers you a prayerful, meditative way to go through Holy Week, walking each of the 14 stations. This is the journey that Jesus made throughout Holy Week. That is the Passion Week. That is the week that starts at Palm Sunday and ends at Easter Sunday. Let us begin. Station 1, Jesus prays in Gethsemane. Matthew 26, 36 through 41. Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took with him Peter, two of the sons of Zebedee, and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me." And going a little further, he threw himself on the ground and he prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want." Then he came to the disciples and he found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not stay awake with me for 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." Jesus brought them to a place called Gethsemane, which is just outside the present-day Old Town Jerusalem and on the outskirts of the Temple Mount. It is desolate and barren, with the exception of thousand-years-old olive trees. As he sat in the Garden of Gethsemane, surely he overlooked the Jerusalem Temple, a symbol of the priestly power and the Israelite dedication to Yahweh, God the Father. However, this was the time he surely dreaded, the last view of beloved Jerusalem. I imagine this was the only place of calm respite that he could find to pray while he was being hunted. The Pharisees are now arousing the other priests and soldiers to search for him so that they can try and convict him, though he has committed no crime. Looking at the terrain, it would have been manageable for him to run away, avoiding the situation altogether. Jesus could have easily climbed over the backside of the hill on which the Mount of Olives sits and escape into the Judean wilderness. When he says to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray," he goes alone to pray. This is a moment and a glimpse into the intimate relationship between the Father and the Son. When he was done praying, he took along Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, and he began to feel sorrow and distress. Here we see the raw humanity of Jesus. He feels the same emotions that we do, sorrow and distress. He even drips sweat that is like drops of blood, showing the great lengths of the agony that he is feeling even unto death. "Remain here and keep watch with me," he says when he asks his friends to stay. Now he's inviting them into a special type of partnership, the kind that demands that we are on watch together. Stay alert, look around, share in the mission. When he advanced a little further, he fell prostrate in prayer and he said, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Relinquishing all pretenses and personal desires, Jesus opens himself up to be used by God the Father in whatever way is necessary. Where in our own lives do we do the same? Are we willing to do what Jesus does in basically saying, "Whatever it takes, God, I will be faithful to what you will"? And now, just in the time that Jesus most deserved supportive companions, he walks back slowly from his prayer time with the Father, and what does he find? Sleeping disciples. Their human frailties are on display, their inability to exert the kind of strength over their flesh that Jesus had hoped. He says to Peter, "So could you not keep watch with me for 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not undergo the test. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Whatever happens in this world, we are to put our hope and our trust in the Spirit, not our flesh. Station 2. Jesus, betrayed by Judas, is arrested. Mark chapter 14, verse 43 through 46. Immediately, while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him there was a crowd with swords and clubs, from the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." So when he came, he went up to him at once, and he said, "Rabbi," and he kissed him. And they laid their hands on him and arrested Jesus. While Jesus was still speaking, one of his disciples who had been with him throughout his adult ministry, one of his disciples who had seen the miracle healings and the feedings, who had participated in spreading the gospel day in and day out, who had been invited into intimacy with the Son of God, that one decides to betray him. When Judas arrived, he was accompanied by his own version of a crowd, different from the crowds who followed Jesus, because his came with swords and clubs, and they included the chief priests and the scribes and the elders, ready to attack. Can you imagine Judas showing up with his premeditated plan and his fan club of adversaries who all want a part of killing Jesus? It's grim to imagine that they would be doing this if they truly knew who he was, if they really understood that they were a part of killing the Son of God. Before he got there, Judas had arranged a signal with them. He said, "The man I shall kiss is the one. Arrest him and lead him away securely." Again, we see the stinging reminder that this was a plan he made ahead of time and on purpose. And so when Judas arrived, he came and he immediately went over to Jesus and he said, "Rabbi," and kissed him. The word rabbi in Hebrew means teacher. It delineates respect and trust. How ironic. We hear this and we wonder how Judas can even stomach the expression of saying rabbi of his beloved teacher in one breath and betray him to death with the next. I pause now to reflect on when we also fall prone to this betrayal of Jesus. Do we renounce our faith and ignore Jesus with one breath and then praise him with the next? In these days, the custom was to greet with a kiss as a sign of respect for one in your inner circle. At this moment, when they saw the signal, they laid their hands on him and arrested Jesus. This expression of human power and authority will not hold our God captive. That is the good news. In heaven, there is no arrest. There is only freedom. Likewise, the killing of Jesus will not hold our God captive, for the power of death does not stand a chance against the power of God. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness will not overcome it. Station 3. Jesus is condemned by the Sanhedrin. Luke chapter 22, verses 66 through 71. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, gathered together, and they brought him to their council. They said, "If you are the Messiah, tell us." He replied, "If I tell you, you will not believe me, and if I question you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." All of them asked, "Are you then the Son of God?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, What further testimony do we even need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." When the day came for the council of the elders of the people to meet, chief priests and scribes, they brought him before their Sanhedrin. Do we truly see how ironic this is? The religious leaders and chief priests are the very people we would imagine have been teaching and awaiting the arrival of the Messiah, those who should be celebrating his arrival. So we must ask ourselves, why were they so adamant on killing Jesus? Was it a question of identity? Did they not know who he was, that he was truly God? Or did it come from that human emotion that we all have of threat and intimidation? Far too often we fall into regarding ourselves as the primary focus, quickly turning on any competition, turning them into threats. Their actions reflect a bit of both. The power that this Jesus man seems to have and the popularity of his crowd-following ministries must have looked like nothing they had ever seen before. I mean, this guy Jesus, he speaks at the winds and the waves and they obey. But how could he really be the Messiah? He was Jesus of Nazareth. Not to mention this ministry that he preached, it was including the outcrowd, the poor, the Gentiles, the pagans. Surely this was not what the Pharisees had in mind for their Messiah. So they ask him, if you are the Messiah, tell us. I pause to wonder that if he had actually told them in his own words, if they truly would have been satisfied. Would that really have changed the outcome of the story? But he replied to them, if I tell you, you will not believe, and if I question, you will not respond. But from this time on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God. We're reminded that belief does not come simply from saying words. We cannot just say words and then all of a sudden believe. This is what Jesus is getting at. Belief comes from faith, and faith is nurtured through living out Christlikeness and reflecting the love of God. When they all asked him, are you then the Son of God? He replied to them, you say that I am. Jesus is using them to remind themselves about who they are claiming he is. In order for someone to believe something, often they need to confess it themselves. So by highlighting what they said, he is making a rhetoric point. He is putting the onus on them and their acknowledgement in the words, whether they believe it or not. And then they said, what further need do we have for a testimony? We have heard it from his own mouth. Station 4. Jesus is denied by Peter. Matthew chapter 26, verses 69 through 75. Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard. A female servant came to him and said, You were also with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before all of them, saying, I do not know what you're talking about. When he went out to the porch, another female servant saw him, and she said to the bystanders, this man was with Jesus the Nazarene. Again, he denied it with an oath. I do not know the man. After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, certainly, you are also one of them, for your accent betrays you. Then he began to curse, and he swore an oath. I do not know the man. At that moment, the cock crowed. Then Peter remembered what Jesus had said. Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. And he went out, and he wept bitterly. Now Peter was sitting outside the courtyard, when one of the maids came over him and said, you too were with Jesus the Galilean. Often this culture, it's showing that one's name is paired with the place of residence. Remember Galilee, Galilean. This is Jesus' headquarters, where he called his disciples, where he healed, he fed, and he preached the gospel. It is right to call him Jesus the Galilean, because this is the identity of his adulthood and his ministry. When she asks Peter and he denies it in front of everyone, it's not a private whisper. It's a loud denial. It's a public audience. This only heightens the dramatic lie as he says, I do not know what you're talking about. When Peter went out the gate and another girl saw him, and she said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus the Nazarene. We are again reminded of Jesus' hometown, Nazareth, and his roots, the identity of his childhood, of his birthplace, of the town where the Virgin Mary received the angel Gabriel's Annunciation, where the miracle of the virgin birth occurred, where God came to earth. Notice how important women are so far in these scriptures. It is the women who see through Peter and who challenge him, who are bold and who are willing to call out Peter's falsehoods. And yet again, he denies it with an oath and he says, I do not know the man. The third time comes around. The bystanders walk over to Peter. They say, surely you two are one of them. Even your speech gives you away. And his frustration is now boiling. His fear is causing him to visibly reject Christ further and further as he yells, I do not know the man. And immediately, a cock crowed. It is not lost on Peter the words that Jesus had spoken. Before the cock crows, you will deny me three times. When he went out and he wept bitterly, angrily, frustratedly, Peter admitting to himself that he had indeed failed the Son of God. He did the one thing he said he wouldn't do. When the Apostle Paul writes about this in his letter to the Romans, he describes that we do the things that we do not want to do, and the things we want to do, we struggle to do. Such is life as a human. In contrast, we look at Jesus. This week is a story of Jesus doing what he says he will do, for Jesus is true. Station 5. Jesus is judged by Pilate. Mark chapter 15, verses 1 through 5 and 15. As soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and the scribes and the whole council. They bound Jesus and led him away and handed him over to Pilate. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He answered him, "You say so." Then the chief priests accused him of many things. Pilate asked him again, "Have you no answer? See how many charges they are bringing against you." But Jesus made no further reply, so that Pilate was amazed. The chief priests with the elders and the scribes, that is the whole Sanhedrin. These are the ones holding the council. These are the people who started this. Whether out of jealousy or skepticism or doubt or envy or protection, who's to say? The scripture lists out the extent of the quantity of people and their roles, because we can now see it's no small, quiet group. It's loud. It's angry. A dissenting group. They bind Jesus, lead him away, and hand him over to Pilate. When we hear this, we must realize that this is an oxymoron, two things that ultimately don't go together: binding and Jesus. How can one truly bind God? That will not last. It cannot last. The power of Christ is so overwhelmingly more than any human or man-made punishment could ever be. For God made us. We are his beloved and created people. God is in charge. The whole of the gospel is the reminder that the truth, that Jesus will overcome the darkness in the world. Wait and see. So now in front of Pontius Pilate, he's questioned, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he replies to them, "You say so." Again, Jesus putting the words back in the mouth of the people who are his challengers. Just like before, affirming that they say this is far more powerful rhetoric than him replying simply, "Yes." The chief priests accused him of many things, which we can only imagine what that list entailed. Even the thief on the cross will know that Jesus is innocent. So what kind of laundry list of accusations could these scribes and Pharisees come up with that truly held water? Again, Pilate questioned him, "Have you no answer? Look at how many things they are accusing you of." Trying to make sense of things, Pilate is trying to arouse Jesus's defense mechanism. Usually, we would be prone to resist and deny any false charges against us, not to mention if they were instigated by the religious leaders. Here, it is so unusual that the religious priests are coming to Pilate, demanding a trial. Typically, Rome would be sourcing their own criminals for crucifixion, not being begged by some Jewish priest to crucify someone who is proclaiming to be the Messiah. Here, surprisingly, it is not Rome who is the instigator. It is none other than the Jewish priests turning on each other and bringing their own to be tried. Pilate is not the instigator in this story. He is the enforcer. When Jesus gave him no further answer, Pilate was amazed, because of the way of the world is to defend itself. And yet, Jesus does not react the way we are likely to. So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, wanting to please people, releases Barabbas, a criminal who has done harm and is dangerous. And instead, they hand over Jesus Christ in his place. This innocent man and the Son of God now stands in a criminal's spot. Station 6. Jesus is flogged and crowned with thorns. John chapter 19, verse 1 through 3. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. And the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head. And they dressed him in a purple robe They kept coming up to him and saying, "Hail the King of the Jews," and striking him on the face. When Pilate took Jesus and had him scourged, the soldiers went to effort to create the ways to mock the Prince of Peace. They spent their time on weaving a crown of thorns. No, not the regal gold type of a crown that our world says a king deserves, but the one that causes pain and reflects death. And they place it on his head. Then they probably ran around town finding a purple cloak to clothe him in the color of royalty, but as pure mockery in knowing that this will end with death. Again, while they are mocking him and their shouts come, they yell, "Hail the King of the Jews." But there is a chilling truth to what they are saying. He is the King of the Jews, and moreover, the King of the world. In the Gospels, Jesus occupies three offices: prophet, priest, and king. King is one of them, as he is the true king, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, standing there in a crown and a purple cloak, being called his righteous name. It's not what they expected, yet it is an accurate title. But then they struck him repeatedly, and the story turns. Station 7. Jesus bears the cross. John chapter 19, verses 6, 15 through 17. When the chief priests and the police saw him, they shouted, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no case against him." And they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" And Pilate asked him, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then they handed him over to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and carrying the cross by himself, he went out to what is called the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha. When the chief priests and the guards saw Jesus, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Now they are finally putting to voice the one thing that his opposers have wanted this whole time: his death. I cannot really think of a darker reaction from God's priests or teachers than to be yelled at any person to crucify them, much less the Messiah, Emmanuel, God with us. It is indeed the grand tragedy of this story. The flawed humanity of the priests is now on full display. Pilate says to them, "Take him yourself and crucify him. I don't find any guilt in him." Wow. Even Pontius Pilate, who is in charge of the Roman soldiers and has no tolerance for disorder or threat to power, even he is reasonable in this moment. All of a sudden, he throws a wrench in the plan of the religious leaders by telling him the honest truth. He says, "I find no guilt in him." And they cry out all the more, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." And as Pilate asked them, "Shall I crucify your king?" the chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." A sad moment in the passion narrative. Here we see just how far gone and how lost people are in their tangled web of desiring power. They have so much hate for Jesus in them that they go to even the lengths to yell out that their only king is Caesar, who is the very symbol of power that includes destruction and threat to the Jewish people. This is disappointing, to say the least. Then they handed him over to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and carrying the cross himself, he goes out to this place called Golgotha, a real place in Israel, titled Place of the Skull, giving it both a sense of reality, that it has a point of latitude and a longitude, a real place, and a metaphor for death. This is the place where people go to die. What a hard thing to imagine that the soon-to-be dead person would have to carry the very weapon that would be used to bring about this, a cross. It flies in the face of any ounce of dignity or integrity that a person could possibly have left. For now, Jesus does carry his cross. Just as the cross will be a sad ending of his life, it is also the symbol that we cling to today to remind ourselves that death did not get the final say. Death does not get the final say. Resurrection and our hope is what is found in what Christ did for us on that cross and on that following Sunday morning. Wait and see. Station 8. Jesus is helped by Simon the Cyrenian to carry the cross. Mark chapter 15, verse 21. They compelled a passerby who was coming in from the country to carry his cross. It was Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus. As the passerby Simon, a Cyrenian, was coming in from the country, he helps Jesus to carry a cross. He's traveled now far into the city from his home in the country. Do you remember who else came from the country, not the city, at the beginning of Jesus' life? John the Baptist, someone who came to help. Help comes in the darkest of times from the least expected of people. Such was Simon of Cyrene for Jesus. He shares the load of the weight of the cross and this unfair, innocent passion that Jesus has suffered. But what does he do? He loves Jesus in actions, not words. Station 9. Jesus meets the women of Jerusalem. Luke chapter 23, verses 27 through 31. A great number of the people followed him, and among them were women who were beating their breasts and wailing for him. But Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For the days are surely coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' And they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do this when the wood is green, what will happen when it's dry?" A large crowd of people followed Jesus. Even to death, people followed Jesus. The crowds in the Gospels are often the symbol of recognition of who is worth following and who is not, including these women who represent the authentic mission and consistency of following Jesus, keeping watch, staying present, despite the circumstances. They are open to expressing their belief, their feelings, their joys, and their sorrows because they seem to be clear about who Jesus really is. They participate in the first century custom of wailing and beating their breast as they mourned and lamented him. This is a common practice as a foreshadowing of death. Jesus turns to them and he calls them daughters of Zion, daughters of Jerusalem. This title here is a powerful statement about their Jewish identity. As in the Psalms, it talks about them this way, Jesus pulling the Old Testament into the new. He said to them, "Do not weep for yourselves or for your children, for indeed the days are coming when people will say, 'Blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bore, the breasts that never nursed.' And at that time, people will say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if these things are done when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" This comes from Hosea chapter 10, verse 8. Jesus is quoting, even on his last day. This is about the coming ruin of Jerusalem and the great horrors which will destroy much of Jerusalem in 70 AD. In this metaphor, when the wood is dry, of course, then it's combustible. It will catch on fire. A metaphor for the fire that will then consume Israel and Jerusalem and the temple in 40 years when the Romans will come to Jerusalem. This is the consequence of the Jewish leaders, the people not embracing God's way, which is brought to them by Jesus. Again, keep watch. Stay alert. Jesus has brought the kingdom of God. Station 10. Jesus is crucified. Luke chapter 23, verses 33 through 34. When they came to the place that is called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots to divide his clothing. When they came to Golgotha, this is the place of the skull, a real place. We're reminded again about the theme of death And yes, they crucify him. But he's not alone. There's someone on his right and someone on his left. The Gospels are sure to remind us that they're criminals. This is the type of company that Jesus keeps during his last day. Of course, though, who is in the center? Jesus, still holding the priority, the focal point, still demonstrating when he says, "Father, forgive them," practicing the forgiveness that he has preached over and over and over again. The forgiveness that is preached on the Sermon on the Mount. The forgiveness that is taught in the temples. The forgiveness that is embodied by our Messiah on a cross. Forgiveness will always overwhelm hate. Station 11. Jesus promises his kingdom to the good thief. Luke chapter 23, verses 39 through 43. One of the criminals who was hanging there kept deriding him and saying, "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus replied, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Now one of the criminals hanging there reviled Jesus, saying, "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself and us." Wow. Even the criminals believed. One of them asks for salvation and deliverance because he trusts that Jesus is God. The other, however, rebuking him, says in reply, "Do you not fear God? Are you not subject to the same condemnation? Because we have been condemned justly for the sentence we received. It corresponds to our crimes." This is such a mature vantage point for the criminal to see that the judgment corresponding contrasted to the innocence corresponding. The innocence of Jesus, a man who they say has done nothing wrong, hanging there in the middle, the cross right next to him. And of course, the penitent criminal asks the thing we all want to ask. "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." He wants the same thing that we all want, eternity with Christ. Jesus replies to him first saying, "Amen." Amen means so be it, a word of comfort for that criminal on the cross. "I say to you today, immediately," Jesus says, "you will be with me in paradise." Paradise, a garden of hope, a garden of eternity, never to be separated from God again. This is the opposite of the log and the speck that is talked about in the Gospels. It is easier to see the speck in another's eye than the log in our own. That example now flipped on its head with the criminal on a cross. Maturely, clearly seeing, yes, his own corresponding crimes and punishment, and even seeing clearer the innocence of Christ, the beauty of the hope that Christ represents, and wanting a piece of it. He has now seen the trueness of Jesus' identity, and he is willing to call it out. Station 12. Jesus speaks to his mother and the disciple. John chapter 19, verse 25 through 27. Meanwhile, standing near the cross of Jesus were his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing beside her, he said to his mother, "Woman, here is your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own home. Standing by the cross of Jesus was his mother, Mary, who saw both ends of Jesus' earthly life. the birth and the death. Isn't it beautiful that God kept her alive for both, only for if to bear witness, to show a mother's love? Yes, then the women are the ones in the story who share the true intimacy with Jesus, from what we can see. They trust him, and he trusts them. What kind of trust exists between a friend that you would give your mother to them? When Jesus tells his mom, "Behold, this is now your son," gesturing to the beloved disciple. And it says immediately the disciple took her with him. He cares for his beloved, Jesus does, even unto the end. He will do whatever it takes to make sure that care and love and compassion and a future are there for those he loves. He will make a way forward. Station 13. Jesus dies on the cross. Luke chapter 23, verses 44 through 46. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. When it was noon and darkness came over the whole land for 3 hours, we may wonder what that means. A theophany, an expression of God's presence in a unique way, and this time marked by grief. Then we hear the veil of the temple is torn down the middle, representing the long-standing separation between God and humanity. It's now been bridged by Jesus. No longer does there have to be a temple curtain that separates God from the priests, God from the people. Now that is swept away by Jesus' faithfulness to the vocation given to him by the Father. In the book of Exodus, there are blueprints for the temple, and it does include a veil. Do you see it? The Old Testament fulfilled in the New, Jesus bridging the gap, bridging the separation, making us closer, taking it upon himself. And of course, Jesus cries out. In a loud voice, he says, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit," and it gives us the appropriate glimpse into the relationship between the Son and the Father. Commend means to present to oneself or entrust oneself to. As soon as Jesus entrusts himself to the Father, he breathed his last. His last breath shows that there even was a last, because in order for there to be a resurrection, there has to be a last breath. In order to be raised, Jesus will trample death by death. Station 14. Jesus is placed in the tomb. Matthew chapter 27, verses 57 through 60. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also himself a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him. So Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn in the rock. Then he rolled a great stone to the door of the tomb and went away. When it was evening, we can imagine this is an interesting scenery. He waited until the night and yet was rushed. The burial culture and customs of this day and age said that the body had to be tended to before the Sabbath, before full sundown. There's a piece of us that hears this story and we want there to be a plot twist even sooner. We want it to happen tonight. But alas, it is not until Sunday. Now we have this rich man named Joseph. He comes in and he, of course, has resources. He has his own tomb, likely a large one, family-sized, enough for him and the members of his family. In this time and culture in Israel, the bodies were taken to a tomb, left there for about a year. The bones were then collected and put into a bone box. This is the practice. This is how we orient ourselves in what is exactly happening, why it is wrapped in clean linens. In Leviticus in the Old Testament, it talks about the importance of keeping clean things clean and unclean things separate. Here now we have clean things wrapping up the Messiah. Perfectly fitting. Joseph is also a member of the Sanhedrin. We're not sure if he was there the night of the council, but we know Joseph is both a member of the Sanhedrin and a disciple of Jesus. A disciple, that means to follow, likely to love. When he goes to Pilate and he asks for the body of Jesus, Pilate easily orders it to be handed over. We can imagine Pilate wiping his hands, glad to be done of this situation, ending a game of what felt like hot potato. He had ordered the crucifixion. Now he orders the body to be delivered. He will move on and wake up with a new day tomorrow. But for the world, everything will change. And so now a stone is rolled in front of the tomb. The body is laid in clean linen, and Joseph of Arimathea has departed. What shall we see but Joseph's devotion to Jesus in spades? In a culture that talks more like, "What have you done for me lately?" It's one thing to care for people who are alive, because why? They can do something for you. But for a dead person, they cannot do anything for you. How will Joseph of Arimathea show his devotion to Jesus? None other than doing the cleaning, the burial, the tending to, the caring for, and the loving on that night of Good Friday. We have now walked the stations of the cross. Together, we have seen the journey of the Passion Week that Jesus has lived through, that Jesus has now been crucified on. The good news is we will gather on Easter Sunday. We will proclaim the resurrection, the ultimate hope that is to be found, for we are Easter people. Nevertheless, we cannot ignore what happened. We ought not to ignore what happened, because what was given on that cross, and where Jesus bore both the sins of you and of I and of all humanity, reconciling us back to God, bringing us closer to God, giving us a glimpse into the promise, just as he did to that thief on the cross. Today, you will be with me in paradise. When Jesus comes into his kingdom, may we await with expectant hope.